You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to Table Talk. Every episode of Table Talk features visionaries from across the food industry, digging deep into the latest innovations and ideas. And today's episode continues our series of conversations with the really big thinkers and disruptors in the industry. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter and gastronaut. Today's topic couldn't be more important. We're going to learn the secrets of how to talk to kids in their own language to get them to eat their veg. Sounds confusing? Take a little listen to this.
They come from deep underground. Water makes them stronger. Sunlight fuels their power. And they will stop at nothing until they've taken over the world.
I'm helping to defeat them.
Join the fight. Eat them to defeat them.
Now, let's be frank here. The vast majority of kids don't particularly like eating their veg. And there are lots of reasons for this. Physiological, social, cultural. But there are also lots of people trying to turn this around. My guest today, he's dialed up the war zone rhetoric and tapped into children's competitive side to win them over and get them to love their vegetables. Dan Parker, chief executive of Veg Power and the mastermind behind the brilliant Eat Them to Defeat Them campaign, which lays claim to having increased vegetable sales by 500 million children's portions. This is no mean feat. Dan, welcome and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me along. The ads we made, they're kind of scary at the same rate that something's like Stranger Things or Doctor Who is scary. So it's kind of funny scary. And they're presented with high melodrama. And the first ad opens with, you know, there's sort of a turnip snuggling out of the ground with a little kind of grin on its face. But the way we do the grins is we brought in people who are modeling people. So they're all the faces are within the veg. They're not animated. And what we want to do is to bring alive, we want the children's imagination to see characters and fun within their food. And then there's a cauliflower going and laughing away. And it wants this wonderful narrative that the veg are coming to take over the world. And then it's got the parents pleading, saying, you know, we've been keeping the veg invasion at bay for years, but we're losing. Kids, we need your help. And then it's about the kids arming themselves for battle and biting the head off a celery and that sort of thing and going out and taking on the veg. And then it's a call to arms, asking the kids to come on, join the fight, eat them to defeat them. And what it does is it sets a tone which in itself wouldn't achieve anything. It's when you then follow through on social, on digital, in schools, in stores, that you then activate that ideas. And we have wonderful stories of kids dragging their parents to the supermarket because they have to get some broccoli because they've got to defeat the broccoli tonight. And then they get their stickers on their reward charts. So we give all the kids reward charts to have at home. And we hear these stories again and again and again, and that's when we know we're getting somewhere.
And I think it's important to note that these are, you know, the tone of these is they're not childish. They are bold. They're beautifully done. They're dramatic. It's not, you know, saying it's an animated vegetable sort of conjures up the idea of a cartoon. It's not. It's much cleverer than that. I think that, and they're really dramatic.
Yeah, and the thing that really surprised me, because obviously it was a bold decision and we were slightly nervous. And I was particularly nervous about perhaps kids who have some special education needs, particularly autism or perhaps some younger kids. But actually, surprisingly, this campaign is fantastically successful in special educational needs environments. I would say it's at its most successful there. And we get lots and lots of letters from parents who've got kids who, you know, perhaps are quite sensitive children in terms of stimulus and things of that nature, who find the campaign immensely engaging, exciting. We got constant requests from people who've got 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds to be involved, which makes me slightly uncomfortable because it feels just a little bit too scary for them. But, you know, we shouldn't underestimate our kids. They're amazing, amazing little ones who just know how to have fun.
Now, before we delve into the complex world of kids' nutrition, just tell me this. As a child, what was your own vegetable nemesis, if you had one? Was there a vegetable that you've always struggled to like? And if so, how did you defeat them?
Of course, you realise you now ask me the toughest question you can ask me right from the off, because behind every vegetable is a vegetable farmer. And whatever I say now, I'm going to have an angry man with a pitchfork coming after me. in response to this interview. So therefore, some sort of might be reserved in my response. I definitely hated mushrooms as a kid. Could not touch mushrooms as a kid. And now, actually, I eat mushrooms pretty much every day.
Wow.
I normally have an omelette for my breakfast. And the funny thing is my lovely 83-year-old mum still thinks that I hate mushrooms because she hasn't kind of moved on since 1984. And so whenever I go to her house, she's like, oh, no, you won't want any mushrooms. And then she serves me up some fish fingers and baked beans. If I think about veg today, obviously all veg is truly amazing, obviously. If there was one veg that I thought was perhaps a little less amazing than the other veg, it would probably be aubergine.
No.
Not a big fan. Don't like eating snot.
You just need to come over here. I'll cook you some veg.
That would be absolutely lovely. My answer to say, how do you defeat the aubergines? Is to bury them deeply amongst other things and cover them in flavouring and pretend they're not there. That's generally the best approach.
We've all got lots of tricks, haven't we? Okay, well, let's start off with why this matters. So most kids, like you, grow out of their vegetable aversion eventually. So why is it so bad? What damage does a lack of veg in their diet cause?
Sadly, the habits that kids form during their childhood, generally they don't grow out of. You know, the National Diet and Nutrition Survey shows that 77% of adults don't eat enough vegetables. Now, that's even higher with kids, but there's really a very, very tiny percentage, the sort of 10-15% of children who don't eat healthy veg who go on to have some kind of dramatic change in their relationship with vegetables. And so actually it becomes much, much harder to change bad habits in teenagers and then in adults. And really we need to set kids off to a good start, because the interesting thing is they pretty much arrive not disliking anything. And it's society and culture and media and peer pressure mostly that drives the fact that kids dislike vegetables. And that's the thing that we need to counter. And yes, there are some vegetables that are perhaps a little bit harder to like when you're young and maybe a bit more sensitive to bitter tastes. But there's really no good reason not to like peas and carrots and peppers and tomatoes and these vegetables. As we know, you know, vegetables are absolutely essential for the development of healthy bodies and healthy minds. And I think the story that really stood out for me recently was the reports that shows that there is, you know, we are having a bit of a crisis in the mental health of our kids, particularly our teens. In just 3 months, nearly 200,000 young people have been referred to mental health services, which is almost double the levels pre-pandemic. And I think it goes much deeper now. And we've heard an awful lot about the levels of sort of bullying and cyberbullying and mental health pressures on kids. But there's been recent research that shows that kids that eat five a day have much more stable mental health. So as well as the obvious physical health, there's the mental health. But the truth is only 6% of teenagers are eating enough vegetables to properly give their body the nutrition that it needs. 6%. Shocking, isn't it?
That's shocking, is it? 6% is really shocking.
And perhaps even more alarming is that only that 23% are eating less than one portion of vegetables per day. And that's a critical state of being in terms of getting the nutrition their bodies and their minds need to develop. And that's obviously our greatest area of concern.
And there's a sort of waterfall of effects. You know, there's things like sleep deprivation, you know, associated with poor diet and all sorts of things that will unfold from the diet, which is not just looking different or being obese. It's really complex, isn't it?
Yeah, at the extreme end of this debate, Steph, we have over 1,500 children that have type 2 diabetes. Mm. You know, type 2 diabetes used to be sort of, you know, older persons, overweight, slow burn condition. And now we've got kids who are living with it and they're living with it quite critically. And the outlook for the whole of their life looks absolutely terrible. Mm. Now, that's just the very sharp point of the issue. But I think it highlights just how concerned we should be generally about our children's diet.
Now, there are physiological reasons for some of this aversion to vegetables. I've done lots of work with kids using PTC strips, which is something called phenylthiocarbamide, which is basically super taster testing. And you suck on a little strip. It's got this chemical in. If you're particularly attuned to bitter tastes, then you will experience this chemical PTC as being incredibly bitter. Now, when you do it with kids, there I would say a good 2/3 of them have an extreme reaction to it and absolutely loathe it. Adults, it's probably maybe one in five taste that bitterness. So it seems that children generally are more sensitive to bitter compounds. And that's, I mean, that's things like brassicas, isn't it? Sort of cabbage. I mean, even broccoli, really, although kids do tend to like broccoli. So there's a range of vegetables which some kids will genuinely find difficult to eat. Does that factor into your work? Have you been sort of focusing, as you say, on things like peas, which have a much sweeter flavor profile, or are you how do you split it up to say, right, I know we're gonna in this ad, because I've seen a lot of Brussels sprouts in the ads, how do you decide which ones to go for, and is there a kind of a low-hanging fruit? Do you want, you know, is it like starting that we'll start them off on peas and then we'll move them up to Brussels sprouts later on?
Yeah, I mean, so you're absolutely right about bitterness, and that's an important thing for every parent to know, is that generally the hormone that reacts to bitterness becomes less active as we age. That's why all old people are so bitter. not true, old people, not true. when it comes to primary school age kids, we focus on what we call six family favourite vegetables. And we choose those, which are peas, carrots, sweet corn, peppers, tomatoes, and broccoli. Mm-hmm. Now, we choose those because they're reasonably easy to like. Right? They're accessible, they're affordable. Yeah, they are a win for everybody in every strata of society. And if you get your kids eating those six vegetables, you're in a pretty good place, both in terms of their approach to food and their nutritional balance.
Yeah.
But we focus on those six. We wouldn't rush to recommend somebody try to get their kids to eat cabbage. You know, if you've got a kid who loves their veg, then great. But giving cabbage, overcooked, boiled cabbage to a child that's not keen on their vegetables is pretty much guaranteed to seal the deal for life.
So you want to start with the low-hanging veg?
Start with the low-hanging veg. I'm not a big fan of hiding veg, because I think that's just solving a problem for this meal rather than solving the problem in life. But try and make it fun. Get the kids touching the veg, cooking the veg, growing the veg. Lead by example. And kids, I think, on the most part, will follow at that point in time.
And what I thought was really interesting about the ads is that they're dealing not so much with those physiological aspects, but the sort of social and cultural aspects. Now, why do kids, and I have this had this with my kids as well, you know, they would eat all sorts, oysters and all sorts, you know, when they were tiny. Then they go to school and they learn that vegetables are uncool. Now, this is particularly damaging and really hard to counter, which I think you've done very cleverly with the ads. But can you explain how you tackled that and what your approach was?
So my background is in food advertising. For about 25 years, I owned an advertising agency working for big consumer packaged goods companies and quick service restaurants and supermarkets. And when we started this project 3.5 years ago, I was very keen to bring the thinking that exists in that space to this space. We started off and we had a look at seeing how have people been promoting vegetables to people and to kids in particular in recent years. And we saw a few themes that were fairly consistent across the world, which was sort of adorable old farmers with wicker baskets full of muddy vegetables, and it's all terribly wholesome or nice, or you know, perfect children running around a 20,000 pound kitchen the size of a squash court. Or my least favourite, the sort of animated dancing vegetable characters who sing annoying jingles. And I think all these things have failed everywhere they've tried. So one of the first things we did is we got kids in and we asked them to bring in their favourite thing. And we stuck all these favourite things or pictured these favourite things up on a wall. And immediately, visually, you could see, we put them next to a whole bunch of vegetable ads. And you might as well be comparing a sort of a muddy field to a disco in terms of how it looked visually, because the kids' stuff was high energy, frenetic, very bright. You know, this is kids. Kids are bonkers, right? The other thing we looked at is we asked lots of different people about why don't kids eat more veg? And we put that to the obvious people like nutritionists and people who work in school food and parent groups. But we put it to supermarkets. We put it to child psychologists. We put it to children's entertainers. We put it to all sorts of people, this one question. And they all came back with their answers in different ways. But actually what their answer came down to was this, is that essentially kids don't like vegetables. In fact, more than that, they think that vegetables are a currency in a battle of wills with their parents. And obviously there are kids who are an exception to these rules, right? And then for parents, what parents care about most is avoiding waste and avoiding friction around the dinner table. Now, a chap from a supermarket last week said a very interesting thing to me. He said the way they view shopping parents is that they're forming a constant risk assessment as they walk around the supermarket. They're saying, will it get eaten? Will it go to waste? Will there be a fight around the dinner table? Will this take me ages to do? Is this going to be bad for our health? Is this going to be bad for the climate? And it's probably that order that they are assessing everything they buy. And the vegetable aisle might as well be labelled the danger zone in terms of your risk assessment around the store. We went and said, right, what we have to do is we have to thaw. We have to get the kids to be excited about veg, and we have to get the parents to see the kids being excited about the veg. So I use the motto, you have to find the fun in the food. Long answer, but this is sort of fundamental to this whole campaign. Is the other part of this is if you want to take people from a journey from A to B, the mistake people make is they start at B, where you have to start at A, even if A is something you really don't like. If you're dishonest to yourself about where the people you're trying to talk to are, then you will set yourself up for failure. So we went to the kids, and we know with kids they like to play and they like things turned upside down. And if you look at the core theme of pretty much every children's story, it's about the parents being incompetent, the kids having special powers, and the kids saving the day. So we said, you know what, kids, you're right. The veg are evil. They're coming to take over the world. And the parents are fighting them, but they're losing and they need your help. Only you can save the world. But there's only one way you can defeat them. And that is to eat them. Right? Now, the kids totally get this is a ruse to get them to eat vegetables. They're not, you know, they're not afraid. No, they get that this is just a, but it's funny. It's a joke and it's silly. And the parents are being silly. And what kids want above all else is for parents to play.
They're not stupid.
And so if you play, the kids go, great. And then the thing that was a bit of a leap of faith for me, they then go, yeah, okay, and eat a spoonful of peas. But they do it, which is amazing.
So, Dan, this all leads us to a much bigger issue, which has irked me for many, many years. And that is, I've seen people going to schools whinging about food and telling kids that what they love isn't good and what they want them to eat is better, despite the fact that kids know very well that they don't like it. And millions of pounds, I would say, have been spent by Public Health England on a whole series of campaigns which I haven't seen any data on success about, and kids hate. They seem to be pedestrian, undynamic, not particularly inventive. Do you think that a vast amount of money has been wasted and is still wasted in this country on campaigns to get people to eat better that haven't been thought through properly and or haven't been haven't taken on board the person that they're aiming their advice at?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of money was spent on Five a Day. And it had some effect when the campaign was on back in about 2004-ish, I think. But it didn't really have a lasting effect. And I think you can argue the psychological toss on that one. I would argue that if you say to people, you need to eat ... you basically said that this is more like medicine than pleasure. Right? So, you know, if you said you're only allowed to eat five portions a day, then suddenly something becomes exciting. So you're only allowed to eat one bag of sweets.
Yeah.
But you have to eat at least five portions of fruit and veg. Well, who's the exciting and who's not exciting? Mm. I think it gets back to saying that A to B thing, the psychology thing. So the sort of you must, or and the message that don't resonate is people don't buy health, they buy happiness. Now, with kids, that's very simple. Kids is how much fun am I having now? That is the only gear that exists with primary school children. Mm. With adults, they're still all buying happiness. It's just happiness is sometimes a bit more complex and a bit more different for each one of us. But people generally will only buy health if it's a pathway to happiness, not if it's a barrier to happiness. So the moment you set your products up and you come over worthy and say, eat this because it's good for you, it's full of vitamins, you won't get diabetes or heart disease, you might as well say, this is disgusting, it tastes like medicine, it's cod liver oil, get it down because you have to, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's almost impossible. If you take a campaign like Eat Them, Defeat Them, which was an immensely brave choice by, you know, it was us with working with Adam and Eve, who are the agency behind the John Lewis ads, and with ITV, who've been our partner in this. And it was a hugely brave decision that could have gone horribly wrong, but we realised the need to be brave if we want to change something. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that a government agency could be that brave, effectively. Mm. Because if it went wrong, we'd all get a bit of reputational damage. If it went wrong for them, it'd be much more serious.
Yeah.
So I don't really think actually that governments should be leading the way on these kinds of campaigns. I think the governments should be creating funds and resources to support, whether it's campaigns around breast cancer or obesity or smoking or whatever it is to put that in the hands of people who perhaps are a bit closer to the issue can really push it with a bit more adventure.
And whose job it is to change people's minds in cleverer ways. Do you think then, I mean, this is, I've thought this for a long time, I wonder if you think the same, that a lot of public health policy is really driven by how it looks when it's reported in a paper. You know, I think Eat Them to Defeat Them, I would imagine, probably, you know, raised some hackles and that people kind of thought, what? Did you get sort of kickback from it? Were there people who said, well, no, you need to go with the old-fashioned way to just tell them that they've got to eat their food?
Yeah, so, I mean, we got a lot in the first year. And then what happened was the kids all went, this is brilliant, and had a great time, charged around, eating loads of vegetables. And we had some, particularly in the first year, we did some very, very sophisticated and complex evaluations on various different levels by some very credible academics. And everybody went, oh, wow, it works. Now, there is still a group of people who don't like what we do. But what I would say to them is what I said to you earlier in this conversation, is they need to start looking at this through the lens of the child. When you look at any kind of advertising campaign or any kind of behavioral change campaign, you know, the skill of the advertiser is to get into the mindset of the person you're advertising to and to really understand that person on a totally emotional level, and understanding what it is that might encourage that person to make the change you want them to change. And unfortunately, much of that skill is put to use to get people to buy consumer goods and unhealthy food and bad pensions, right? But it can also be used to encourage people to make more positive changes. And we've seen some fantastic successful public health campaigns around that. So I would say to the people, and I'd say there are still some people who push against this, is come and look at the results. And if you really disagree with me, come to me to a school and see how much the kids love it. And just take the leap of faith that you have to think like a child if you want to talk to a child.
Okay, well, let's deal with the results and the evaluation that you talked about. I've heard a few stats, increased vegetable sales by 500 million children's portions and things like that. Can you give us the basics about this and tell us how you can tell?
Yeah, so it's always hard. Any kind of evaluation has fundamental flaws in it. So we do different kinds of evaluations, and the basic principle being if they're all pointing in the same direction, then they're probably right. If you take that stat, there's an organisation called IRI who collect basket data from most of the supermarkets, and they very kindly give us all that data. They donate it to us for free. And we use a method called econometric analysis, which is a little bit beyond me, but I just about keep up with it. But what that essentially does is it tries to isolate all the different influences on a product, both positive and negative, tries to understand the scale of those influences, like, for example, the weather or plant-based diets or COVID, and then tries to isolate their impacts so you can understand the impacts that different things have had. And it's a complex science. And we had this modeled by an outstanding data scientist. And then we had it reviewed by Professor Susan Jebb, Oxford University, and Professor Martin White at Cambridge University, who are both considered absolute thought leaders in the world of sort of food and food behavior. And they're happy with the model. And that's what the model says. Now, that's just covering our 2019 and 2020 campaign, which is about a £63 million growth in veg sales, about 500 million children's portions. To support that, we do three other things. One is we run a national YouGov survey asking thousands of parents and kids about the campaign and how it affected them, what they did. We then go into the school. So our campaign, this campaign has two parts. We have a big national TV advertising campaign and celebrity support kindly donated by ITV, Channel 4 and Sky. And then we have a schools program, which this year went to 470,000 kids in 1,800 primary schools. So we do a close focus on those primary schools, and we talk to the parents and we talk to the kids and we talk to the teachers and the catering staff, and we do surveys with them. And everything points in the same direction, which is positive. So to give you an idea, we just completed the 2021 campaign, which is our biggest yet. And we've not done the econometric analysis on that yet because we have to wait for the sort of tail on it to run. But we've done all the other evaluations. And what we saw was that for kids who weren't in the schools program, 21% of the kids said they ate more vegetables and 18% of the parents agreed their kids eat more vegetables. So we're there or thereabout that about a fifth of children, 1.2 million kids, ate more vegetables in direct response to the TV campaign. Then we would go into the schools, where what we do in the schools is we work with the caterers, we do theme days, we do stickers, we do reward charts, and all sorts of activities going on inside those schools. We see that figure lift to 59%, say the kids, and 59% say the parents, so they confirm that. And then the schools, 83% of them say they saw an increase in veg consumption in the school. And actually quite notable is they report about a 25% reduction in waste, because most of the stuff that's going in the bin is veg. Every single one of these methodologies you could pick to pieces if you wanted to pick to pieces, because they all have flaws, because all evaluation does. But they all point in the same direction. So therefore, it's probably true. So therefore, we should keep going. Is really, in truth, as honest as any evaluation of this kind of thing can ever be.
Yeah. And also, from my point of view, what I love about your campaign is that it's not just, you know, you can't expect just that campaign to achieve the objective. It's part of a whole attempt at changing the way of thinking, which is a massive mountain to climb. And I think starting to do it in the way that you've done it is absolutely brilliant. I'm really impressed.
If we're successful, then these kids, when they're grown-ups, will go, eat them to feed them, when they see some vegetables. That joke will live forever.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way, if you're a child from my generation, you might say, watch out, there's a Humphrey about when you see a pint of milk. That's still in my head every time I see a pint of milk. And, you know, it's been 40 years since that campaign last one. Right?
I'm just going to stop the interview for a second to mention a couple of other recent editions of Table Talk, which are really relevant to this conversation. We had a fascinating edition asking whether food advertising bans really affect public health outcomes. And there's another on how to tackle the growing child obesity crisis. Both of these are in the extensive archive on the website. Check them out at foodmatterslive.com. Now back to the interview. Now, you're an advertising guy. How much do you think advertising, to blame is not quite the right word, because advertising is about people trying to sell the thing that they're trying to sell. But obviously, there's a vast spend on advertising for soft drink and sweets and things like that. Are you at some level locked in a battle?
Well, I think, first of all, I would say that it would be, I think, impossible to overstate the desire and ability that advertising has to shape our culture and our habits. And anybody listening who thinks that they're not susceptible to advertising, they are the most susceptible to advertising, because they don't know it's happening to them. And I could tell them what in their lives they're doing and not just what they buy. But to give you one example, the idea that we're all desperately busy is a complete construct of the advertising industry in order to sell us washing machines and dishwasher detergents and various other things. And actually, we have more leisure time today than we've ever had in modern human existence. So we spend most of it with a computer screen.
Mm.
Right. So, you know, we are in competition for the hearts and minds of children when it comes to what they eat, and for the adults in terms of what they eat. But there's a slightly wider battle, isn't it? There is a truth, and I think this goes back to what can we say that Five a Day achieved and the Eat Well Plate achieved, is that most people know what they should eat. Right? And they know that the things that they are choosing to eat are not good for them. They're not good for their children. They're not good for the planet. They're not good for animal welfare. They're not good for our rural communities. They know all these things, but they choose to buy those things. Now, some people's choices are very, very limited by their financial situation. But in truth, that's a relatively small percentage of the population, though, of course, it being any is a terrible thing. But for the majority of people, they have a degree of choice. And people choose to make these choices rather than those choices. And if we want to fix these things, we have to ask ourselves the question as to why they make those choices. And that is the question that everybody who works in public health should be asking themselves, is not why don't they choose vegetables, why do people make the choices that they do? And a lot of that comes down to the fact that people want to take their time and their money and put them into other things. Because and so a very interesting central theme in all public health issues is convenience. We saw this an awful lot during the pandemic, is that the pandemic's a very mixed thing. What happened with food is that some people ate notably healthier, some ate notably less healthy, and many people did both at the same time.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot more vegetables and a lot more wine, right? A lot more chocolate and a lot more fruit, right? When we start to strip it back, and we did some analysis on this recently, we see that convenience is such an important part of this decision-making process. it's a Tuesday night. We're busy. We're stressed. We're tired. We want to be able to put a pretty good meal on the table without too much effort. And we need to find a way, vegetables in particular, to make sure that it's perceived to be not inconvenient and not risky. And those are perhaps the greater challenges than taste or health.
And what's interesting is you're tackling the environment within which this story is told. You're shifting the power to kids, which I think is part of the brilliance of it. I'm interested in what you think about table manners. It's a completely different subject, really. But I remember when my kids were growing up, I'd sort of make this food and I'd put it on the table and I would want them to eat it. When my kids smeared, you know, food all over their face, I was thinking, what are you doing that for? Stop it. And I would sort of try and get them to eat food in the way that I wanted them to eat food. And there was a real revelation when I kind of thought, what am I talking about? If you want to mix your ice cream with beef, then that's fantastic. You're experimenting. You're trying things out. If you want to smother it all over your face and then put it in your mouth, that's an experience. You're going through a sensory experience. And I had a real, it was a Damascene conversion. You know, I suddenly thought, you've got to play with your food. And for me, I had very strict manners taught to me when I was a kid, and it put a barrier up between myself and enjoying food, I thought. And so I stripped that away from my kids, and I allowed them to do pretty much, as long as they weren't throwing it on the floor, as long as they weren't wasting it, then it didn't really bother me too much. Do you have a view on this? I mean, I think that table manners are part of the battle between kids and parents that make meals less fun or less of a gift to them.
Yeah, I think you make a very interesting point. And I mean, table manners, if we look back, are essentially a sort of middle-class affectation from the Victorian era, aren't they?
Mm.
You know, they're an invention that wouldn't have existed 300 years ago, even at the most basic level, right?
Yeah.
I think the most important place is to make the dinner table a place of joy. And that's not always easy to do because we're all tired and we're all stressed at that point in the day. And as you say, I'm going to agree with you wholeheartedly. As long as they're not throwing food around or stabbing each other with forks, right? It's just what you should be doing is laughing and having fun. And it's not just about food. It's also about family bonding and mental health. And God knows I've been there. I mean, how many times have we sat around the family dinner table and it was a worst part of the day? You know, we've all had that. And it's not how we want our families to come together. So I'm going to wholeheartedly, I haven't really thought about it in the way that you expressed it, but I wholeheartedly agree with you. It's going to be mayhem in our house at 6 o'clock this evening. It'll be all awful.
Wiping the walls down in the morning. Okay, so let's move on now. I believe that you're moving on to a new campaign to get people eating and buying more seasonal British veg. Is this true? Can you tell me anything about it?
It is. I mean, we're not moving on from what we do. We're scaling up Eat Them, Defeat Them, so we go to 1 million kids in schools in 2022, and that's going to kick off in February. I think we're going to, can I, if I mind if I go for branching out, is, yeah, our kids campaign, obviously we started with fairly modest means and we managed to rustle up about £8 million worth of free stuff every year. But still, it's a fairly modest means from which that's done. And if we're honest, £8 million puts vegetables on a par with pickles in terms of marketing budget. but what we're very interested in next, as a step we started moving towards this year, is, you know, millennials are now 24 to 41 years old, right? And Gen Z are now 23 at their oldest group, right? The parents of today are millennials and they are digital natives. They're much more consumer conscious. They're interested in plant-based diets and they're just a different generation now of bringing up kids. And, you know, we all know they're very interested in these issues. And the wonderful thing about veg is that veg is part of the solution to climate change. It's part of the solution to health. It's part of the solution to Brexit, is to eat more veg. And we want to, what's happening, we've done a study of people who are leaning towards plant-based diets, and what we're not actually seeing people do is leaning towards more plants. What they're leaning towards is quite a lot of sort of highly processed, not particularly healthy, high carbon footprint, ready meals and processed food that happens to have no meat products in it. And actually, really, if you care about these issues deeply, then you should be looking to make sure that you, at very least, eat the amount of veg that the Eat Well plate says you should. So we're leaning to around the themes of seasonal vegetables. Our survey recently showed that 80% of people would like supermarkets to make it easier for them to find seasonal vegetables. It also showed that if we matched a person against a dice, the dice had a better knowledge of what's in season when than the person. It was fun doing the stats. But generally people do care and they do want to know. The other thing I think ties into this, which is very, very interesting, is that Kantar recently reported that 650 million meal occasions are changing on a permanent basis. This is the work from home lunch, hybrid working, the work from home breakfast. And we're seeing 650 million meal occasions change that aren't actually particularly well defined at this point in time. So they become opportunities, I think, for veg. And also, I think another pattern we're seeing emerging is that people who are hybrid working, they're making their work from home days their healthy days, go to the gym, have healthier food, spend more time with the kids. And then they're having their work from work days a little bit more indulgent and go to prep and get a snack and probably not do any exercise. Okay? So we want to lean into these trends and give people really a building around three themes, which is convenience. So it's really quick and easy to put together a decent, healthy lunch. Kitchen smart. So, you know, it's not gourmet. An awful lot of the food sector is interested in what I call Saturday night recipes, when you don't mind spending an hour and a half and using every utensil you have in order to produce something that's magnificent. Right? But actually what people really want is get the job done on a Tuesday recipes. And that's actually more about tips and tricks than anything else. So convenience, kitchen smarts, and then seasonality. Because seasonality really captures the idea of vitality. It's good for increasing variety, which is fantastic for your gut health and hopefully opens you up to new vegetable tastes. And hopefully makes you go that actually it's not about swapping the peas on your plate for beans. It's about adding the beans to the peas. So you've got bold choice, two different vegetables on your plate, right? To illustrate this and how we might bring something like this to life. So this November, we have a campaign that's around tray bakes. And what we want people to do is to double up the amount of vegetables that's in their tray bakes so they can use the leftovers. Very easy the next day, stick them in a blender. You've got a soup, add some couscous, you've got a salad. You know, there's your kind of free lunch the next day because you've done all the work the night before. Mm-hmm. What we'll do to bring that alive is we get fantastic support from social media influencers, from Jamie and Prue and Hugh Funny Whittingstall and through to many, many fantastic TikTokers and Instagrammers and people who share our passion for food. And we'll get this idea out through that network. We'll create some information sheets that we'll distribute through public health teams, healthy weight programs, schools, nutritionists, other people. Will give them some really nice assets that they can use that will actually will strip tray bakes down to the basics. What's a tray bake? How does it work? What vegetables need how much time? And what could I do with my leftovers? And then we'll leave all the fancy chefs to come up with all the exotic different kind of tray bakes that you can do. Mm. Ours is just about getting more value out of that tray bake. So that kind of really practical and seasonal, because we'll do it this autumn and it's all squashes and roots, which are in season in the autumn. So it's seasonal, but meal occasion led.
Yeah.
Just hopefully help people navigate their way through just feeding themselves and their family.
Okay, so that event-led approach is interesting, because a lot of the people that you've mentioned, so Jamie, Oliver, Prue Leith, Hugh Fanny Whittingstall, who are all been helping with Eat Them, Defeat Them campaign, I believe, they've all been saying this for years. I've been saying this for years. Loads of writers and TV programs have been trying to get people to eat better for years. I mean, it's endless. What have we all been getting wrong that you will get right? And what is the difference in your approach that will make you succeed, whereas other people, and God knows, you know, we've all been doing it, but we haven't succeeded in transforming the nation, unless we've made it less bad. What is, how are you going to succeed in this area?
Okay, I think to understand that answer, we need to dissect the various things that have been going on. And what do we see? We see, I think, I would argue probably three or four things, which is all the chefs. What chefs do, particularly chefs who work at that sort of high profile level, is they want to dazzle and amaze with their fantastic culinary genius and their great entertainment personality and their comedy. And essentially, that's that Saturday night recipe, isn't it? I mean, anybody who's done a Jamie Oliver 15 minute meal knows it takes 45 minutes and devastates your kitchen, right? And none of us want to cook a meal on a weekday night that devastates our kitchen because we don't want to spend half an hour clearing up. Right? You know, I kind of have a principle that no meal should take more than one dishwasher load of equipment to clean. Otherwise, you're coming down in the morning dirty dishes, which none of us want to do. Right? So that's great, and it serves a purpose, but it's entertainment. And yes, it is inspiration, but I don't think it's necessarily what you might call empowering or educating people. It also attracts people who are interested in that kind of thing. Second thing we see is lots of brilliant documentaries about the issues relating to food, which again generally gets watched by people who are interested in the issue of the politics of food. And so they're slightly preaching to the choir on awful lot of those documentaries, with some exceptions. And I think Jamie did some amazing work around his kind of school food type stuff. We see some lovely projects in schools, which are great, but they're always limited. And what we're perhaps not really doing is we need to go and find a way to talk to the people who are not potentially interested in what we have to say. Right. So, you know, I'm very interested in lower income families. So the very lowest income families, their challenge is actually having something to eat. And Marcus Rashford and others are doing amazing work on that, and a full power to them. Where we're interested is if you look at people whose perhaps household income is around £15,000 to £30,000 a year, that's actually where it's the biggest demographic group for having children. It's families, it's ordinary working families, as the politicians are so fond of saying. And unfortunately, the health data on almost every metric you can look at is quite poor in that group compared to families who've got more money. So the question we're really asking is, how do we go and talk to people in that group who are not particularly interested, and they're either busy or certainly perceive themselves to be busy? And I think we need to think about the format of our content, very, very short form. We need to make sure it's entertaining and engaging, but also we need to step into, it's almost, you mentioned table manners earlier. I think to some extent what we're teaching people is a degree of housekeeping, a degree of parenting, because actually you can't disconnect food from parenting and housekeeping. And so it's, and then there's just loads of tricks. We talked about cabbages being bitter earlier on. Well, cabbages are sweetest in June and July. Carrots, for example, are fantastic raw in sort of July, August, September, October. But actually, by the time you get to spring, you're not going to get much flavour out of them because they've been sitting around for a while. So really, you need to be thinking about roasting them in order to make them edible. We could go on forever with tips and tricks that will help people to serve better food. Back to the tray bakes and other things we're looking at. And in for Chinese New Year in January and February, we're going to teach people the absolute basic principles of stir fry in less than 60 seconds. We have a thing we push out through 10,000 primary schools, which is called 60-second lunchbox makeover. And the idea is that how can you improve the vegetables in your kid's lunchbox in less than 60 seconds? Because that's as much time as people are going to commit to it. And if we start to think in this language of helping people who are not necessarily too engaged and moving away from the language of either lecturing about health or teaching people to be cordon bleu chefs, then I think we start to get to hopefully we get to somewhere that's more successful.
One thing is PHE funding. Now, if Public Health England had 10 million quid and they were minded to put it to you, would that be a good thing or would that be a bad thing? I can't work it out. I've been pondering this for a while. And is that helpful or is that a ball and chain because you're tied to objectives that you don't necessarily believe in? Well, you know, because funding for your project is going to be an ongoing issue, and I think you've done incredibly well already. But should the government spend their money better and just say we trust some people to do something exciting? Here's the money, or will that just become loaded with all sorts of boxes to tick that you don't necessarily want to tick?
So we've had 4 grants off central government, not particularly big ones. 2 from PHE and 2 from DEFRA. We've had grants from Welsh Government, we've had grants from Northern Ireland Government, and we've had grants from lots of local governments. They're very keen to work, because we'll bring to the table, to that partnership, celebrities, media groups, corporations, schools, community groups, and what have you. And the government's very keen to work in that collaborative fashion rather than do things in isolation. There are, of course, conditions that come with that, but there'll also be conditions that come with that for us. You know, as we just simply won't do something with them that we think is going to send out the wrong message. We won't do something with them that we think is going to be overly arduous in terms of the amount of project management and bureaucracy it's going to place on our organisation, which will be crippling. But in all fairness to all of them, there's a huge great desire to work with organisations like ours, and there's a great desire by them to make it possible for organisations like ours to work with them. And so I'd be very, very impressed. Now, in answer to your question, if the government is of a mindset to spend £10 million on promoting vegetables, which I really think would be an excellent idea, Yes, I think they should stick it out. I mean, I have a bit of a joke with some of my contacts in central government is if they've got 100 grand to spend on the campaign, we'll give them a £500,000 campaign. If they do it themselves, they'll get a 20 grand campaign. Right? Because the moment the government turns up, everybody increases their prices. The moment we turn up, everybody decreases their prices because we're a nice little fluffy charitable project and quite right and proper too. We can also be braver and more dynamic and faster moving. Now, what we're hoping to do on two or three fronts at the moment is we are at the moment trying to convince the government that it should get behind seasonal vegetables because British farming needs a lift. It's good for climate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it needs a decent amount of money put behind it that we're not going to be able to find without their support. The other project that we have in its infancy at the moment is we are just starting a project to collaborate with a number of other organisations and initiatives to work in schools in a highly coordinated curriculum compliant fashion, rather than each of us turning up for 6 weeks and doing our thing, but actually working together with some decent sponsors. And again, Veg Power is all about building alliances. And what we'd ideally like to do, and as I say, this project's not off the ground yet, what I'd ideally like to do is to take some schools, let's say 25 or 50, and prove over 3 years that we can actually make a lasting and meaningful difference. And that means in measurement around waistlines in year six, it means in actual veg consumption and general attitudes to food. And if we can make a difference, so we say, well, actually, okay, so here, finally, here is a blueprint, because there's no blueprint anywhere in the world for success. If we can establish a blueprint and say, here's a blueprint, it costs £3,000 a school, there are 25,000 schools, please, Mr. Johnson, can you write a cheque for 75 million quid to save our kids? And we can't, we or nobody else can really make that argument at the moment. The evidence base is just not strong enough for a blueprint to back. And we hope, working with others, that we can create a formula for success. And if we do that, it's just a matter of how big a cheque the government is willing to write to deliver that success for our kids.
Exciting, exciting concept, exciting times, I guess. Okay, last question for you. The key 10-year goal for Veg Power, I believe, is for every child to be eating one more portion of veg per day. How far away is that goal? And once that's done, what will be the next goal?
Okay, so I mean, how far away is that goal is hard to know. We are trying to turn a tanker with an outboard engine at the moment. But what's encouraging actually is the National Diet and Nutrition Survey has the most recent one has showed a drop from 33% to 29% of children eating less than one portion per day, and a drop from 94% to 89% of children eating less than 3.5 portions of veg, which we think is ideal. Now this is still terrible numbers, but actually what it is for the first time in I think, yeah, let's say forever, but certainly in modern memory, where that curve has turned and the figures are positive. And does that, and I'm not going to take credit for that because some of that happened before we existed. I just like to think that we're pops having to pedal at the critical moment. That's encouraging, right? We need to keep going and we need to do more. And will we achieve it in 10 years? It's hard to know. I mean, there's a very famous public health campaign called Got Milk, which is held up as one of the great campaigns of all times. It's an American campaign, went on for years. But the assessment of it at the end was it probably slowed down the decline of milk consumption. And if probably slowing down decline is what victory looks like, well, I'm not going to accept that. And I don't think the people who support us are going to accept that. And so we need to be bigger and we need to be bolder and we need to be braver to make sure that there's not the outcome.
Excellent. Okay.
In answer to the second part of your question, it says, if we manage to achieve that, thankfully, if we manage to achieve that, I think I could probably put my feet up on the beach, retire and feel happy with myself. But I would say there are probably two. Yeah, I think the area beyond that is goes back to that kind of group of most critical need. That third of kids are really eating no veg. And unfortunately, they're also the kids who are obese and also the kids who are eating too much sugar and also the kids who are doing no exercise. And there is this little segment of our society who are in a terrible, terrible place. And the more we can do to support that group on vegetables and wider public health issues, and the more we can be talking about it as a society, then I think we can start to really make a difference where it's most needed.
Dan Parker, thank you so much for joining us. I think that's thoughtful, dynamic, and exciting. And I'm really glad that you're the person in charge of it.
Thanks very much indeed. Thanks for your time, Steph.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters Live. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like some of our other podcasts. There's editions from food security to editions with disruptors like Josh Tetrick. Recent highlights include editions on turning the tide on obesity and the truth about protein science. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatterslive.com. Thank you so much for listening.